Well, thank you so much for your time. Our rationale. We both feel fairly busy, and life is pretty full.
We know
the podcast has been, such a gift to be able to do this together, and we're learning a lot entrepreneurially. But it's a great excuse to go meet new people,
network,
refresh friendships, network, learn, and then as the audience grows, I think there's such a feels like a huge hunger for the people that are on the fence entrepreneurially or starting something, and just not everybody has the support network that I feel like you and I have been gifted with. I'm sure you have those core people. Not everybody has it. So we want the podcast to serve as that encouragement, inspiration, excitement, learning. And it's not that we do not have it all figured out.
No.
But just to meet the people that have done it and are doing it really well. And so that's what brings us up here,
I think, is
to get to know your story. So we are here with Kirsten Moore of Magpie Diner here in Harrisonburg, Virginia. It's a full-service breakfast and lunch restaurant. And it's important to us because it's been such an inspiration for what we want to do in Lexington. More of that to follow. But so much of the vibe, the atmosphere, the food is just, it's beautiful. And it's really awe-inspiring. And you hold a special place in our household, believe it or not, because I told my, she said, "Oh, who are you doing on the podcast this week?" And I said, "Kirsten from," mom was like, "You're going to talk to the mayor of Harrisonburg?" And I was like, "Babe, I mean, I don't think she's been the mayor, but
no,
I could be wrong.
I have not been the mayor, and I do not want to be the mayor. But, that's the rumor, but yeah, no.
But in our mind, you are, and you have been the mayor. You're everything up here. So thanks for your time. We know it's valuable,
and we're excited
to chat with you, all things entrepreneurial.
Yeah, definitely check out Magpie. This is my first experience even pulling up to the building, and it is so cool to see. What you can tell is an old building that was definitely something else, which I'm excited to hear about. Maybe even a generation ago, you can tell it's a pretty old building, but it's redone so well. I mean, it is impressive. So if you're in the Harrisonburg area or passing through, you definitely got to check it out. We've had a great experience this morning. Really
sweet
cool
spot. Great. Yeah, we're coming off a full breakfast now, which is great. It's all fresh. Can you give us your backstory? Have you always been an entrepreneur? Is this your first go of it here at Magpie? Kind of what brought you here?
Yeah, that's a long and twisty story, but my mom will tell you that ever since I was a little kid, I was like, I want to do it myself. Like no one could teach me to tie my shoes. No one could help me with things. I wanted to do it myself. So naturally that translated to me not being a great employee for other people when people were telling me what to do. And so I always had that, always kind of had that bug in the back of my head that like, it would be much better if I could just do things the way I wanted to do them.
Yeah.
My grandfather was an entrepreneur. He had a boat and camper RV company in the 70s in the Midwest. So I guess maybe some of that gets passed down too, but I mostly come from a family of teachers and artists. Mm-hmm. So there's that. My background is English and art. So I was a graphic designer by trade and marketing professional. And then I kind of got into food and entertaining and cooking. But when I was working in marketing, my oldest son was like 4 years old and I was working full time and I was trying to figure out like, how do you find a really great daycare for working people? So there were great daycares, but they were like 9 to 12 and I'm like, I can't drop him off, go to work for 2 hours, go pick him up and call it a day.
Yeah.
I need something that's like substantial and good and educational. And one of the women that I worked with, she said, "Oh yeah, we just moved from Kentucky and they had this great Montessori school there." And before I could stop the words coming out of my mouth, I was like, "Let's make one."
I'll do it. Yeah. True entrepreneur.
Yeah, like just solving the problem, right? So we talked about it a little bit and we put an ad in the paper when that's back what you did, and put an ad that said like, "Hey, we're going to have this sort of informational exploration meeting at the library." And we had like 50 people show up. So clearly this was a need that people were looking for. We met people there who were certified Montessori school teachers. We created this committee, and we opened a Montessori school, and it was great. It's still running today. We sold it to to one of the people who was at the original meeting, so that's kind of cool. Whoa. But that all started with just like, hey, if there's a need in the community, if I have a need, chances are somebody else has that same need. And if you do it, then it fills that gap and people will come and it's logical. So my entrepreneurial things have happened because I've seen a gap in the market or something that I wanted to have around and made it. So, because nobody else was.
Yeah, that's entrepreneurship, like in a nutshell, right? What's our favorite quote recently? Problems are opportunities in work clothes.
Yes.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
That's a real, that's, so that was your first, like, I'm going to start something.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then how did we get to where we are today?
So, I always entertain through big parties, all kinds of stuff. And everyone's like, you should open a restaurant or a catering company. And I said, both those sound miserable. and then some life things happened. I was working in marketing and design, doing business development work and marketing for some corporate places. Life happened. I got divorced. And I was having lunch with a friend who wanted to open a shoe store. And I was struggling with what to do with my time and how to like kind of make ends meet as a new single mom. And she said, you should teach cooking classes. Like, everybody's always asking about that. And I was getting calls that Christmas about like, who does that? And I'm like, okay, fine, I'll do it. So I created a company called Taste, and it was sort of a four-pronged company. First and foremost, it was going to be teaching cooking classes. And then I was going to do design work for food-based businesses. And then I wanted to get back into food writing. I had done a stint as a food writer for 3 years, so had really gotten to see the back end of like how restaurants work, which was really fascinating. And then if and only if I had to, would I cater.
So, the fourth prong.
Yes. Everything, prompt. And then everything happened in reverse. I didn't ever teach a cooking class, and I never want to teach a cooking class. I never did any design work for food-based businesses. I did get back into food writing. I had a stint with the Stanton News Leader for 3 years where I was their weekly food writer, which sounds amazing, but if you have to go out to eat every week and write about it, your pool gets very small.
Yeah.
But it was fun. And then I had a friend who knew a couple who was getting married. Their church, like, committee was going to cook the food, like the fellowship committee or whatever it was. And this wedding kept getting bigger and more extensive, and they, like, backed out, like, a month before. They're like, we don't think we can handle this. And so they were kind of at a loss.
Yeah.
And so my friend said, hey, you should talk to Kirsten. She's, like, toying around with this idea. It's great. So we met, and they had a pretty low budget. The wife was a vegetarian, and I asked them what they had planned, and they had like a carving station. I'm like, why would you have a carving station as like something central in this big important day in your life if that's not part of who you are? And so we just reworked everything. It was in the middle of July. I'm like, people will give us like zucchinis and tomatoes and like, you know, everything's so plentiful and gorgeous right then. So we changed this menu. It was out at a bed and breakfast. It was beautiful. He was a soccer coach and the soccer team was our staff, like unpaid staff. And my friend that recommended me helped me do it. And it was such a beautiful thing. And people loved this meal so much that they came into the kitchen and they hugged me and they tried to take leftovers. And it was this moment where I'm like, okay, this is the moment when food is starting to become part of who people are and what defines them. And it also brings people together. It's this connector. It's this universal language. And even though it's not my party, which is what I reacted to when people said that at my parties, I'm like, why would I want to throw parties for other people? It was this moment of like, oh, this also brings joy to watch these people come together and eat this food and connect and celebrate around food. So I sort of ran with the catering company, and I was working for an architecture firm at the time doing their marketing. I'd take off Friday, prep, do a wedding Saturday, clean up Sunday, go back to work on Monday. So I was hustling hard for a while.
Yeah.
I was so busy, and all of the weddings for the first probably year and a half or 2 years had some connection to that first event. Hmm. And I think the budget for that first event was like, I think it was maybe like $7 to $10 a head. And we did this gorgeous spread of food, which, you know, will never happen today.
Not replicable. Yeah,
it was
not
where it went, we did it. We pulled it off for what they were trying to do. And of course nobody got paid, but it was really fun, and it really kicked off something in me that recognized that that's like an important piece of what people are looking for in that. And so we were offering custom menus for people based on what they wanted to their guest experience. You didn't get to like get a list and say, you know, pick from the chicken and right. green beans.
Here's all the Sysco products and here's our price points. Yeah.
So it was very, very deliberate, very seasonal, and that just hit off at the right time. And I eventually sold that to one of my employees who then ran it again for another 6 years. So
cool.
Yeah.
Something that's awesome about that part of your entrepreneur journey that I want to highlight is I think about entrepreneurship, it's easy for me to kind of pigeonhole it into, okay, you have to have this business plan. You have mm-hmm. to have, like, I might need to raise some funds or save up the capital mm-hmm. or whatever. All these sort of nuts and bolts, when really a lot of things that are very successful or that lead to the next successful thing begin with a passion or begin, you kind of can sort of walk backwards into it. Like, oh, I didn't realize how much I was going to love this. That was for Jill with photography. She just started shooting. She was working at a marketing firm. Mm-hmm. She loved photography. It was sort of her little side thing she enjoyed. In college, she took some photography classes to kind of learn the mechanics and all that. But she just started shooting, you know, other young girls and guys in her office that were getting engaged. She'd be like, oh, can I take engagement pictures for you? Just for free. You know, for probably a year she did that. And, you know, eventually years later led to her shooting huge weddings all over the world, you know, but she kind of backed into it. It wasn't like a business plan. Like, I don't hear you saying like, I knew I was going to get into food.
And that
was,
you know,
but that's really good, I think, for people to hear is like, entrepreneurship is problem solving, but also like, you can approach it. You can find those problems or you can find that passion and start there.
Right.
Versus having to have this, I don't know. You know what I'm saying, Daniel? Yeah. A lot of guys, like guys and girls we talk to even about starting businesses, we talk a lot about the nuts and bolts with them. Mm-hmm. Like, what's your business plan? What's your costs? Yeah, what's your balance sheet?
And it hamstrings you.
Yeah, and you get caught up on
all
this stuff.
I always caution people when I talk to young entrepreneurs, too, about feeling like you can't start until you have all that figured out. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, we've all done it. Like, someone wants to see a business plan and some numbers, and they're just made up numbers, right?
Yeah. Until you're going, you're like, this is what I hope happens.
Yeah. Right. Like, in a perfect world.
Yeah.
I mean, I look back at some of our, like, I remember someone had given me this really great spreadsheet that, like, populates itself as you put in data when you're planning to open a restaurant. It was super helpful. And it was basically having you estimate like how many covers and how much they'd spend. And so I'm just, you know, again, I'm just guessing, like, I don't know. And my husband was like, do you really think you can feed 100 people a day? And like, for us, a slow day is 150. So like my numbers originally were like way off.
Yeah. Way off. Yeah.
And you don't know, just don't know. And so some of those things you have to get into and just really kind of see where it goes. And you have to, I think one of the key things about entrepreneurship is you have to be willing to sort of evolve with it and change. And I think one of the things that happened, say, during the pandemic when a lot of restaurants closed, is they only knew how to do it one way, and they only knew how to, like, stay on that path. And a good entrepreneur knows how to, like, pivot. Like, watch what's happening and you know, like, change as the world around you changes, or the competition around you changes, or your numbers change, or your overhead changes. Like, you have to, like, always kind of be thinking, like, where does this go? And you're watching the path unfold in front of you instead mm-hmm. of dragging it behind you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you started the Montessori school. You did the successful food thing. When did you, you know, looking at, now we know Magpie, but when did you know, okay, I want to stick with food and food service?
Never. Never knew that. Yeah. I still don't know that. Yeah. So the catering company, I was tired of that schedule. It was just grueling. Yeah. And
because you're still working full time.
Yeah. And I said I was just going to close it. My one employee's like, "Oh, but you worked so hard to create it." Like, and I'm like, "Do you want it?" She's like, "Yeah." So we made a little deal. Mm-hmm. But then I created something called Sub Rosa Supper Club with another friend, which was the antithesis of catering. And what it got back to was sort of that throwing a party thing where it's more intimate and intentional. We were releasing dates without any information. So it was just like, you know, October 16th. Buy a ticket.
Yeah.
You don't know where you're going, what you're eating, who's going to be there. And then the day before the event, we would send them an address, and we would have these gorgeous, like, 7-course meals in the middle of, a dam in the national forest, or in a greenhouse, or on a rooftop, or, like, places that people didn't know existed. And so it was sort of the antithesis of being told in the wedding industry, like, I want the toast at this time, and I want this.
Yeah.
It's just like, you're going to eat what I feed you, and you will like it.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, and so I was doing the cooking for that. My friend was doing the styling. It was a beautiful thing. We ran it up until last year. We've paused this year with those dinners. But super fun, and it got me back into the world of loving food again, because I got kind of tired of that for a while. But then I was not, like, other than that, was not into the idea of food. And my husband has some family members in the restaurant industry, and it was always sort of the line in the sand for us, like this is great, but never a restaurant. They're toxic, they're terrible, they're horribly run, there's no money in them, all that stuff. And then one day we went out after a Christmas party or something, and we were looking for breakfast, and we could not find anything that sounded good to us. And we ended up, like, everything either was, like, full or not appealing or not good. And we somehow ended up at the truck stop south of town, because at one time was kind of good. And we were just eating these horrible eggs and drinking terrible coffee, and everything, nothing had flavor. It all tasted like oil. And I'm like, how hard is it for people to make, like, good eggs and coffee? Like, is that too much to ask? And we both love breakfast. And then we were just kind of talking, and I'm like, what if we sometime opened a, like, what if it was a breakfast restaurant? Then it's just the daytime. You don't have the evening stuff. And that was, like, years before this even came on the radar. So that was just sort of, like, seed planted, line crossed, whatever.
And your husband was amicable to it at the time?
He was at the time, but he was also probably hungover from the Christmas party. Yeah.
It was a good time to ask him.
It was a good time to ask. Yeah. So then we had the co-working space. It was right next to the architecture firm that I was working for.
You all started a co-working space while you were at the architecture firm.
Yeah, so the architecture firm that I was working for, we actually expanded it into that space, and we didn't need all of it. So the owner and I had explored these ideas of how to, like use the rest of the space wisely. We went down to Richmond, which was sort of following what they were doing down there with some of the co-working spaces, and opened that. And then at some point he's like, no, I need to focus on my firm. Like, I don't want to do anything with it. You just run with it. So we ran with it. And then I had developers approach me about this purchase. They purchased the building across the street, which is now Liberty Street Mercantile, which is also ours. And then the lot across the street, this building, the building that the cidery is in. So they purchased all of it in one thing from an old tire company called Big L Tire. And they called me and said, hey, we bought a building that I think you might like. Can you come take a look at it? I think it'd make a great co-working space. So I came, walked in the front lobby. I was like, this needs to be a diner.
And it was currently like a tire shop.
Oh, yeah. It was bad, too. Oh, the pictures are pretty rough. So that was the lobby area. But I immediately, like, when I was doing design work, I would immediately, like, if someone was explaining a logo project or something to me, when they were explaining what they wanted or their vision, I would have an immediate, like, solution in my head, design solution. And I would do my requisite 3 to 5 options, but they always picked the first one. Like, my gut was like, I really trust my gut on a lot of things. And when I walked in here, I had an immediate vision for a diner. And it, even when I went home and put stuff on sort of a vision board to share with the developers, when I go back and look at it, it looks a lot like that now. Like, it's very cool. Similar. So had this instant sort of vision for that, walked around. I told them, I said, you know, give me a week and let me make a slightly different proposal to you. And called my husband, like, I think I found our breakfast place. He's like, oh no. So then we just moved forward. Yeah. Cool. It took some convincing of the developers, because I have never run a restaurant, and they, you know, it's not an industry you just jump right into. And so they agreed.
How did you meet the developers? That's interesting. That relationship sounds like
key. Yeah, I don't
even
know. I always tell this to entrepreneurs too. Social capital is huge. Like, people would yell at me for giving away so much of my time to people who would ask for a cup of coffee, or, you know, were like, ask about, like, you know, will you talk to me? I'm like, of course I'll talk to you. Like, that's how things get done in small towns, right? Like, you know people, you make those connections, and you don't do it with the intent of, like, using them someday, right, but you do it with the intent of, like, having a support network that helps you do what you want to do. Mm-hmm. So I had spent a lot of time being social, and people knew me for my food. People had come to my parties. People had been following what I had been doing. These developers had asked me before about spaces, but they kept buying, like, really boring buildings behind the mall, like the, like, strip mall stuff. I'm like, yeah, no. I said, and I think I at one point told them, I said, you know, hey, call me when you buy something cool. And this, I guess, fit the model of cool for them. So,
oh, that's so neat.
Yeah, so that was a lucky thing. I didn't really have much of a connection with them.
Well, that's another important thing I feel like to highlight, is just that social piece of how important relationships are for doors opening. Mm-hmm. And like you said, not from exploiting somebody or weird, like, I'm going to meet you to hope to get something out of it, but more like it's just fun to meet new people, like us meeting today, who knows what possibilities come of things, you know. It's just cool to be able to, I guess, like, keep sowing those seeds. And that's something, like, entrepreneurially, I know that you and I have both seen the benefits of
through the podcast.
Through the podcast, which has been really fun.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. So you had the vision.
So I had the vision.
You walked in the door.
Yep. We started. We started renovating. I'm trying to remember in which order this happened, but so I'm like, okay, so they agreed to do it. So basically they would renovate the building minus the furniture, fixtures, equipment. So it would just be the structure. And then that would be my lease for the next 5 to 7 years, whatever we agreed on. And it's a historic tax credit renovation. So they want to get their tax benefit back from that. And then we can talk about purchasing the building. So that's a cool thing too.
Yeah.
So then I realized that, okay, so there's that piece of it, which is a lot of money, but there's also the piece of it that's the business, and that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So I, again, did a fake mental number of what I thought this would cost, you know, got some estimates on equipment and all that stuff, furniture, all those pieces. And then I'm like, okay, I need this much money. And I don't have that much money, so I need like some investors or an investor. So I talked to various businesses that had investor groups. I talked to one brewery that had, like, I don't know, 15 to 20 investors.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, I don't want that.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, how can I do this as streamlined as possible? Because, again, I like doing things the way I like doing things, and I don't want to have lots of fingers in the pot. So I started making a list of everybody that I knew that supported me with my work with food, and also had resources. And then I remembered at one point I had a conversation with Mark Siciliano in a meeting. And if anybody is listening to this and knows Mark, he'll go down any tangent at any time. we were totally off topic, and he said, you know what this town needs? And I said, a diner. And he said, we're looking for a building. We'll define the building, and you do the diner, you do the business. And this was years, maybe even before the breakfast conversation with my husband. And it just popped into my head, like, oh, I wonder if that's legit. So I reached out to him first, and he loved the idea. We met, had coffee, and then he said, if we can get my wife Anne on board, because it was her family's LLC that was going to be the investment, then we're good to go. And so we met with Anne, and she loved it too, and they jumped in at half of what I thought I needed. Mm. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
But they came in at half, and then I had a mentor in New York, and I asked her about, like, should I keep going and find the rest of it? She's like, why would you do that? Just finance the rest of it. So it took some convincing to my husband that we weren't going to be living in a tent in the backyard. But, yeah. We financed the rest of it. So that was great. So it was just a single investment partner, the developers, and then we financed the rest. It turned out to be like a quarter of what we needed to get started. But the pandemic happened at both the wrong time and the right time. So there was a lot of funds and finances that that were able to make that transition really smooth for us. So that was amazingly helpful at the time.
So you didn't have to take on new investors.
No.
That's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were able to get through with it. Were you able to just increase your financing portion of it as you had things?
We didn't even have to do that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really cool.
Yeah. So.
And your mentality at this point was, I'm all in. Was it, this is going to work? Did you have it all figured?
No.
What were you thinking at that time?
When the pandemic hit, or when we realized I didn't have enough money?
Maybe both. Like, yeah. when you're moving towards this thing, yeah, that you thought you'd never do.
Yeah.
What was going on in your mind? Like, was there confidence that this would take
root? So it's funny. I was always really confident in that. And, you know, when we talk about people like following a path, I feel like it has to be also an informed path. Like, there are lots of people who are like, oh, I make really great barbecue, so I'm going to open a barbecue restaurant, and don't have like sort of the rest of the information around it to make it successful. Mm-hmm. First thing I did was hire a bookkeeper. Second thing I did was hire a chef and a front of house manager, because I don't know anything about running a restaurant. The chef that I hired, she's amazing. We think about food the same way, so her food felt like my food, and so I knew that like that vision could be carried by somebody else. I knew I didn't want to be in the kitchen. I kind of kept moving forward, and I think for the first time in my life, it was a project that I knew that I was in over my head. Like, usually I'm like, I got it, I can do it, whatever. This one I was like, I have no idea what I'm doing, and I needed to get people in the right seats to like make it be successful. When we were doing the construction, I was down here every day, and I would go home and sit in the tub and listen to a podcast called Opening Soon. And it was by two restaurateurs who both had failed restaurants, but now own, I think, Tillit, the chefware company. And they would interview chef owners, and like, sometimes I would sit there and be like, yeah, sweet, I checked that off, I did that, yeah, two steps ahead of you. And then sometimes I'd be like, oh my gosh, like, how did I miss this? But it was just really helpful in me just kind of thinking through it, like, step by step by step. And it's really just one foot in front of the other kind of thing. But I knew, I was admitting for the first time the things that I didn't know. Like, I don't know all these answers, and who can I get on board that does? So I have this amazingly strong team that's helped me get to this place. So that's been really great. But, we just kept plowing forward, and it was a renovation process, so we had a lot of time to think about it, and then the pandemic hit, so.
Yeah.
Did you have to pivot? The pandemic hit before you opened?
Yeah, so I was, at the end of 2019, I was sort of stomping around being like, why are we not open yet? Mm. And then early 2020, I was stomping around being like, we have to be open this spring. This is like prime time in Harrisonburg with all the college kids, and we need to be open or we're going to miss out. Mm-hmm. And then when the pandemic hit, I maybe curled into a ball for a few days. But also, like, my heart went out because I had been really involved with the restaurant community because of my writing. And so I just knew how many people were relying on this industry to be alive and healthy. I had all my managers hired, and we did a quick pivot. Like, within a week, we talked about it one Saturday. And again, the like just doing it kind of situation. Talked about it 1 week. By the next week, we had this online platform up and running where we had an online market. It was called Local Magpie and Friends Local Market. And we were baking our bread in a high school that was closed, which was great practice for our bakers. So they were, you know, testing out a bunch of things. And we were getting restaurants who had closed their doors that were still making some of their favorite dishes. We were offering that up for people to order, pre-order. We were working with farms that we work with, local producers. So we had meat, cheese, vegetables, milk, fresh flowers, like restaurant, favorite restaurant food. And we had this online platform and people would just send us what they were bringing that week. And we had two pickups a week with over 200 people a pickup each time. And it was this great way to just show like, hey, we're at some point going to be competition for people, but we're also part of this big community. And even though we haven't opened our doors yet, like everybody's really important to us and like, you know, rising tide and all that. And it really helped some people just kind of make it through that if it wasn't a huge revenue boost for them. I mean, we did it just out of the goodness of our hearts, like didn't get paid. Mm-hmm. We didn't make money off of that at all, but and they were like, should we give you a wholesale price? I'm like, no, give me your retail price. We're not taking any of that. Like, you need to get paid. So we just really sort of put ourselves in a place where people understood what we were about too. Like, this is community and this is nurturing each other. So we did that until we needed to focus on this. When I curled up during the pandemic, it was like, at the time, like politically, everything was a disaster.
Oh yeah, like, everything was so charged.
So charged, I was like, we literally and figuratively cannot sit at the same table together right now. Like, we're not allowed to be in the same physical space. We can't theologically sit down together.
Yep.
And then I pulled myself out of that, and I'm like, this is exactly what we need. A Magpie is exactly what we need. We need this place where like there is community and gathering and being together. And when we first opened our doors, we didn't even offer takeout, and people were pissed about that. Like, they were so mad.
Just because they had gotten used to...
Well, they were like, but we want to eat your food and you're not being safe. And like, and I'm like, well, but like, our food isn't meant to be put in a box and driven across town and eaten in front of the TV while you're watching Netflix. Like, our food is meant to be eaten around a table with people that you love in this space. And so we stuck to our guns on that. And
love that.
Yeah. So
she's speaking your language, Dan. Oh.
That's powerful.
Yeah.
So that, it sounds like, I didn't know that part of the story, but that it showed people what you were about. Mm-hmm. So transitioning from the pandemic to
opening
not
doors.
Pandemic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Really paved the way for you and gave you traction right off the bat. It feels like you're slammed all the time. Is that the case?
Yeah, we were commenting this morning. We were like, I mean, it's basically
is it Saturday
packed.
Today?
Yeah, yeah, we're like, this is like a Saturday on a Wednesday. This is awesome.
It's funny. I still run into people who are like, I haven't been to Magpie yet. I can never get in. I'm like, on certain days you can't get in. We are busy, like I said, our slow day is like 150 covers, which is for a lot of restaurants is like.
Awesome. And it's a big restaurant, I guess it's not like that's. As I was just sort of quickly counting tables, that's a good turnover in the time frame that y'all are open.
And then when we have the patio, it's another third of our seats too. So, cool. So we missed the patio in the winter. The first winter during the pandemic, we had people sit outside all winter long. We were filling up the propane tanks like twice a week. And we had one couple from Wisconsin who would come with an ice scraper to scrape off their table in the morning so they could sit there.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
And we were all just like, what? And then as people got more comfortable, that died down. So, you know, I still don't even know what a normal year looks like. Like, I really don't. Like, we had that, and then the next year the patio was less, and then this year no one sat outside all winter long. Like, I think we filled up the patio heaters like once or twice all winter. So, you know, you're still trying to figure out what that flow is. But for the most part, we are a very busy restaurant, and we're a volume-based restaurant, which is an interesting model. Because when we're not busy, then things are painful.
Can you explain volume based to the audience?
So we have to have butts and seats to make it work. And when we stop doing that or things slow down, like January and February are really painful. We People just, you know, in January, people make resolutions about not spending money or eating out or eating pastries. I'm sure you see that too.
I hate January.
January is the worst month for a baker.
Everyone's like, I'm not going to do it. No carbs. Spend all my money. But
you know you're going to quit in March. Just don't even try.
They stopped drinking, you know, it's like dry January too. So we're not selling cocktails. We're not selling pastries. People aren't going out and spending money. So, we started something called Friday Night Meltdown to like just ease the pain of the January, February, which is a Friday night happy hour grilled cheese night. So it's a menu of gourmet grilled cheeses and tomato soup, one appetizer, one dessert, and then cocktails, beer and wine. And that's been really popular, and it just takes the edge off. It's not like earth shattering, but it just takes the edge off. So we've learned how to kind of balance that. And one of the revenue streams that I had originally counted on was doing events in the space down here. Like the patio is great for rehearsal dinners and like private cocktail hours and things like that. But we're so busy and our kitchen is so tiny. Like our kitchen is literally built to handle maybe 200 covers, and on a weekend we've done up to 500 covers. So it's tough. So there is no room to store event food and do a whole nother set of service. So when we open this, we have an event space at Liberty Street Mercantile called the Loft at Liberty Street, across the street, that we have a catering kitchen in, and so we've been able to add that to the revenue stream. We just opened that in October.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that's nice, and that will also help balance things. But yeah, volume is tough because when there's not a lot of people, it's hard. Mm-hmm. But we've been really and it's funny, a lot of restaurants in this town, because of the colleges, are busy when school's in session, but they die in the summer. It's hard for restaurants in the summer. We actually get busier in the summer, if that's possible.
That's awesome.
We get a lot of tourists and out of town people and people driving through, and I don't know, there's a reputation out there, and we're really glad for that.
It feels like a destination. Yeah, when we pulled up to this little complex of buildings down here, I mean, my wife was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's the kind of place that, very much like, let's go to Magpie.
Yeah.
Let's drive an hour to go there.
Yeah.
Would you say your business is volume, like, is the cafe volume based? Because the cafe currently is not that big.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere near the size of this, in terms of like butts and seats kind of thing.
Yeah. It's a good question. That's why I asked. Mm-hmm. It was more for my sake. Like, what qualifies as volume based? I think our price points are higher, but I think we err on the side of volume based. What would be the other side?
Basically, for a restaurant to make money, it's like it's either more people in seats,
high plate price,
a higher price per plate, or people are spending more when they come. So you're upselling a cocktail or a side of bacon or whatever that is, so that like what people spend per person goes up. But those are your only options.
I think we're volume based.
Yeah.
I think we're volume based. And we don't do cocktails and such. Yeah. But it's an interesting thought.
You also don't do like a full, we were talking about this at breakfast. You also currently don't do like a full breakfast. Mm-hmm. You have lunch sandwiches, but there's not like eggs and bacon on the menu at Season's Yield right now.
Right. We would love to be there.
Yeah.
We
so will be there. You mainly have pastry and coffee.
Right.
So maybe there's, I don't know, I'm getting into way out of my wheelhouse, but maybe there's more margin on that than like bacon. You got to get good bacon. You can't really, you know,
that's what we talked about this last time. And this is to your point, but I'm curious how you approach this idea that there's an abundance of agricultural resource here locally with high price. People are doing sweet veggies, sweet meat, high price point, which doesn't equate to the volume-based model. How do you approach this, the valuing of good products and then wanting to keep things at a manageable price? The price this morning felt like, we come every Saturday. Like this is,
And we were talking about getting bacon from me, and it's like, our bacon's so expensive.
Some of that's intentional.
I wrestle with it.
And we've tried really hard, probably to our own detriment, to keep prices so that people can come back regularly. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of what creates community. So we have one guy that comes every day from Mount Solon, drives every day for breakfast. Cool. We have people that come in multiple times a week. We have people who have celebrated like all the good things. We have those same people who have come. We've had two couples this spring who the husband died within a week of each other, and they both came with family to like be together. And I'm like, that's to me as important as those like, let's, you know, it's my birthday or it's whatever. But like when someone feels comfort and connection and care here, like that's where we want to be. So that makes me as happy as the people that choose to celebrate the good things here too. So we've tried really hard to make it an accessible place. We're really conscientious about where we are in this community. The Northeast neighborhood, which is a historically Black neighborhood, is just across the railroad tracks from us. Like we're right on the edge of that. Trying to make it a place where everybody can come. I sometimes walk through our dining room and feel like we have such diversity of clientele here that like it just like it feels really good. I think we're probably on the back foot of that again, and as you know, like ingredient costs just keep going up and labor costs keep going up, and it's just we're having to reevaluate that pretty carefully again too, but trying to maintain that. And part of that for us was we get things locally when they're in season and when they're accessible, tomatoes, peaches, all those really great summer things. But for us to like rely on someone to provide local greens at the volume that we use them is would make your salad twice as expensive as it is now. And we cook seasonally. We cook fresh and clean, and somebody somewhere grew that lettuce, so somebody somewhere is benefiting from us purchasing that. I love the idea of it, but it's just not feasible for a restaurant as large as ours, and at the price point we want to keep it to source everything locally. And yeah, for us the clean, good, seasonal part of it is
the key.
Yeah, you could, some things you could do at the Sub Rosa.
Yeah, right.
Pizza, it just does not work.
But they're paying $150 for a dinner. Totally. So. Yeah. They're not
volume based.
Yeah.
Not $15 for breakfast.
Yes. Yeah.
You have used the word nurturing a few times. We use the word nourishing. I love that. There's this idea of community. How are you curating this feel that you just described downstairs? How does that actually play out? Because we feel it. You feel it when you're down there.
Yeah.
How does that happen?
So I think some of that is just when I was building this out and sort of envisioning where this would go, I saw a lot of toxic things in restaurants that I didn't want to happen. And when I explored, or I would ask my friends in the restaurant world, like, how do you do this, or why do you do this, or what's standard in this? I don't know, I can't even think of an example, but they would tell me, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense at all. Like, so dumb. And so I just started approaching it again from, like, if I were the dishwasher, like, why don't I get paid like everybody else? Because they're the one that keeps the restaurant running. And, you know, why don't the servers share their tips with back of house people, because they're serving their food, and what they're being tipped is a chunk of also what they're being put in front of people. So we've approached everything from sort of a teamwork standpoint. The servers pool tips, they tip out the back of the house 10% of their tips. All of those tips get paid out in payroll so that they have real live paychecks to show people when they want to move forward in life and buy a car or a house or whatever. So it's not about like sort of grabbing the good tables or like, oh, I don't want that customer because they're not as fun to wait on, or they never tip as well. So everybody works together. We've just fostered that teamwork spirit from the beginning. We've tried to eliminate the hierarchy in the kitchen as much as possible, where all of the kitchen staff is trained, cross-trained on everything. So they're able to help each other out, and there's not like you answer to me and you answer to me and this person's on the bottom of the heap and they do whatever we tell them.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think we've just sort of made a little bit healthier environment, and people have gravitated towards that. We got lots of people who left other restaurants. We have sort of the cream of the crop of people. Plus, it's daytime. Like, they don't have these horrible hours. Right. So we had one guy who came, well, a couple of them, who were heavy drinkers when they showed up. And because of the lifestyle change, I mean, they're not working till midnight, drinking till 2, sleeping till noon, and doing it all over again. They're like having a real normal life where they come in around 7 and they work till 3 or 4 and they make the same amount of money as they do working those evening hours, but you know, can go home and go for a run and have like completely transformed who they are. So that's been really fun to see too. Rachel Fitzgerald is our head chef, and she's amazing. And she has done such a great job of cultivating that positive culture in the kitchen. She used to be a teacher as well, and so she's also really patient and has really just again nurtured people to be their best selves. And
I like that. This is a small thing, but I noticed that at least the two guys that were serving our table, they didn't have like a uniform on. I thought that was cool. It's like, I thought, this isn't an accident, because you either choose to have everybody wears the same white shirt or not, you know. And I thought that was cool, because it was like they were just in whatever was, I mean, they were clean, you know, but whatever was comfortable for them, like a t-shirt and like jeans, I think, you know, one guy had on. And I thought, that's cool, because it makes me feel at ease. Like, I don't have to be wearing anything.
It relaxes you.
Yeah, they're just nice guys that know what they're doing.
Yeah, and that was intentional, too. I don't, like, and especially in a large restaurant, I don't want it to feel like a chain. And I also want personnel, like, the servers to have their own personality. So we've had people who have, like, been very distinct dressers.
Yeah.
And it lets people know who they are. Like, I think that's kind of cool. And it just, it's like, removes another barrier between you and the customer.
Love that.
Yeah.
I wanted to get back to, you mentioned you started with leasing the building, and then there was another part of that story with buying a building.
Yeah. So they don't even want to, when I did this building, that wasn't even on the table.
It was just straight up, you signed like a 5-year lease.
Yeah. Seven year lease with this one. So when that's up, then we can talk about that. And you know, again, you shoot yourself in the foot a little bit, but I couldn't have done it if they hadn't, if we hadn't structured it that way.
But you've created all this value in this building. But now
I've created value, so when I do go to buy it, I'm going to be eating
that. It's
going to
be a bigger price tag.
How far into the 7 years are you?
We are at our 4th year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're on the downhill.
Still so young.
Yes.
Yeah. On that note, you mentioned several pieces of it. What has growth looked like since you occupied the space?
Yep.
And then what does it look like from here? Because I know your mind's always...
Yeah, so we just finished Liberty Street Mercantile across the street. That building was sitting there empty, and it's funny, I don't even really remember paying attention to it when we were doing this. And then they put up a for lease sign, and I kept seeing them show it to people. I'm like, do not mess up my quarter. Please don't put something in there that's dumb. Yeah. And so I just approached them and said, hey, why don't you just give me the building, and I'll do all the work and all the tax credits and all the stuff, and you don't have to do anything. I will get all the tenants. I'll have one lease with you. We'll make a clause in there that the option to buy it after 5 years is on the table right from the start. They're like, sure, great. So, because they loved what I did here, they now trusted me. With this one, I had to do a little arm twisting and convincing that I knew what I was doing. But with the other one, so we moved forward on that. I had one friend who has a flower shop next door at Blakemore's Flowers, and she wanted part of the building, but this building was in rough shape over there. Have you been in it yet?
No,
we're going to walk across that.
It's post and beam. Like, I just assumed it was concrete like this one. It's very different. It's like 1904. This one is 1940 something. So very different. And she's like, I want like part of the first floor, but I don't know how to get it from the way it is now to where I want it. And then what do you do with the rest of it? And so I reached out to her immediately and said, you can have half the first floor. We'll get tenants for the rest of the spaces. the top floor immediately spoke to me again, sort of that immediate like vision for something as a event space, which we don't have downtown other than the hotel. And when I was catering, people were always saying, isn't there a venue downtown? Like, we like want to do that and then go out with our friends to our favorite places. And so I knew there was a market for that. And we opened in October, end of October. And I can't even count how many events we've done already. And it's just, and we don't even have our website done. We don't have, I just hired my third full-time staffer up there to like manage and
that's deal awesome. With all it. It makes sense though. It's amazing. I mean, even in our small town with our two small colleges, there's several event spaces. It's amazing that Harrisonburg, with such a big college, doesn't have, like, that could be a whole industry. You could probably make another two, event spaces in the right buildings anyway. Yeah.
And it's a big building, so the event space can hold 300, which is great. Yeah. But it's also, like, feels intimate at the same time, so it's kind of cool. And then we moved the coffee roaster that was next to the bakery across the street so that they have more room and also seating. And then we're going to expand the bakery into their space so they will double their size, which is still small.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. Man. Yeah. So I feel like my growth is always sort of organic. Like, it just, like, one thing sort of informs the next thing. And you know, like, the event space is the next thing, a little hotel or lodging of some sort. Yeah. So we're keeping our eye on things around the area.
Nice. I think it's a great idea.
So it's good. I'm done with construction for a while. Yeah. I would like to be done with construction.
How are your days spent? You're the owner of Magpie. You're not in the kitchen. You have hands here. How are you managing your time? What does your day look like?
A couple of weeks ago, I actually made myself a custom planner where I have two sheets of paper, horizontal, four columns on each, and it's each column is something that I have to pay attention to each day. So there's Magpie, there's the bakery, there's the perch, there's the mercantile, there's the loft, and then something at home, and then something personal. And every day has four lines on it. So when I, instead of creating this long to-do list that just gets endlessly long and not organized, I put things on certain days. And when those four things are filled up, I can't possibly do more than 32 things a day, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's still a push.
Still high capacity,
And I might shrink the next version of that to like three lines. But I've had to really sort of just compartmentalize and prioritize where things, you know, get paid attention to. I'm doing the social media for most of the stuff right now too. So there's just always things to be doing. And I have a high capacity for multitasking, and I like the activity of that, but sometimes I tiptoe on the edge of feeling like I need five of me. And one of the things that I did when I set up the structure for Magpie was I wanted to pay myself. Like, I didn't want to just do this and hope that there's a payout at the end, but I wanted a salary. I've always felt like I've sort of pieced together my life with freelance work and side things and whatever, and I wanted something structured, and it's fine, but it's not like, if you had to replace me, you'd be paying four times that to do all the things that I do. So, but it, again, it feels fine to me, and but it's maybe not sustainable. So
yeah.
Just to take that a step further, I'm familiar with that feeling too. So that often for me is a cause for concern, like, oh, I'm doing something wrong, I need to increase margins or what. How do you handle that tension of, I don't know if this is sustainable, or physically it is, but just, this isn't what I want to do for the next 20 years. Where do you take that? How does that play out for you?
So I think the natural response of an entrepreneur is like, I'll just do it all myself because then the margins are bigger, right? But it's not, if I left, like if I died in a car accident this afternoon, then what? Like, you're going to have to hire basically four C-suite people to like be doing what I'm doing. And so you have to like move in that direction. I have a friend who has a nonprofit in New York, and she's been working her tail off on this thing and not paying herself. And I had that conversation with her this summer. I'm like, you have got to find a way to pay yourself, even if it's just a little bit, but there has to be some structure in there so that this has longevity and can get carried on in some way. And she started doing that. She's like, it's life changing, both for like the sense that your work has value, and mm-hmm. also that you can see sort of a path forward too. Mm-hmm. I don't like. Do you pay yourself a salary, or do you just?
We do. Yeah. That's within the last 2 years.
We did 4 years of not.
It feels way better.
Right.
Certainly.
It changes how you feel about work and how you feel about what you're doing. But also then, again, it gives you a path forward. So, like, and it's always a pain point to think, like, when I hired this third person for the event space, I'm like, ugh, like, that's, mm-hmm. like, another that's supposed payroll. To just be a cash cow and, like, not, like, have all this overhead. But if she can do all the things that I'm doing right now and sell it 100 times more than it's mm-hmm. selling on its own, mm-hmm. then it's great, right? Yeah. But there's always that point at which you're like, what's the cost benefit there?
Right.
So,
right.
Do you silo each of your operations? Like the event space is on its own financially, or do you use some Magpie?
No, it's all swooshed together.
One.
It's all one LLC, which is tricky. But we also share a lot of staff. We have our kitchen staff and servers sign up for event shifts, and we also have a bigger pool than that, but we give them priority.
Having a good bookkeeper then is really essential.
Keep
everything straight.
And then the tricky thing is, like, we have a facilities manager for both buildings, which is great, but then, you know, when he buys a drill, is it for like, does it get lumped under that building or this building, or you know, where it's all gets a little muddy, but
we have a little bit of that with the wedding venue versus the farming versus the lodging. You know, what's paying for what? It can get a little confusing. We have different credit cards to try to keep it straight. Buy it with this credit card, that way we know it's this expense. That is interesting. I wonder, well, as you continue to grow, if that might change. I guess that's
It may at some point.
Especially if you, I don't know if this is like, I'm interested to hear if this is at all in the future. Like, would you ever think of selling different parts of the things? Because if it was in its own
LLC.
Every day. Yeah, that would be easier.
Definitely. So that's an interesting thing. So we get asked all the time about, like, putting one of these, a Magpie, somewhere else. As far as Saratoga Springs, New York, I think is the furthest request we've had. And also probably the most serious one. It's not something that I have a lot of interest in, because for me, to scale something like this, we have such creativity and such, like, immediate ability to make cool things and make things that are delicious based on what we're feeling, or, like, and my chef, like, we just came out of soup season, and she makes the most beautiful soups I have ever eaten in my whole life. Like, it's sort of that under the radar thing, like, soup's kind of like soup, right? But hers are incredible, and I keep telling her, like, her first project needs to be a soup cookbook. We have the ability for her to just, like, feel her way through those things and not have a have a set standard of things that are replicable right now. We're also loving being invested and a part of this community, and not someplace where I'm not there 9 months out of the year or something, that I'm just popping in once in a while to check on things. I don't like that feel. What we like here is, again, the community coming in, the regulars, the celebrations, all of that stuff, and being really, really invested in this place. This end of town was just dead. There was just the poultry factory and empty buildings. And when we were renovating Magpie, people said, do you think people will even go down there?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Now we were joking before we started recording, I think you're the unofficial mayor of Harrisburg.
So,
How's the things for
sure? Yeah. That's awesome.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Do you have any closing thoughts?
Well, I've really enjoyed our conversation. I think there's so much for me that I'm going to be taken away from the conversation. I really appreciate your industriousness. Your high capacity is really fun to be around, and I can see how you've attracted great people to build out a team. I think that's an encouraging thought for me. Daniel, you've done that really well. And we have two at Big Spring. It's just, we just have two besides Jill and I, we just have two employees. They're wonderful. But even things like thinking about a bookkeeper again, that's something I've had a bookkeeper. I've not had a bookkeeper.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, we have an awesome accountant, but you know, I don't know. That does most of our bookkeeping. Anyway, I just think there's lots of great nuggets, but overall, I feel like the energy of being in a room with you and hearing your ideas for things, it's really encouraging. I hope our listeners picked up on that. And we didn't really describe this building, but it's kind of like the Flatiron building?
Mm-hmm. In your, yeah.
It's like that building. This building's a big wedge. It's three stories.
Two and a half stories. It's weird. Yeah.
Restaurant on the first floor, co-working space upstairs, and it's in this little corner of the city of Harrisonburg that was all these industrial little buildings that are having this resurgence. And anyway, it's a really special place. So you're a special person. It was really great to sit down with you, and I can see your vision working itself out in these buildings. Who you are working itself out in these buildings. So really cool to see that.
This is fun.
Yeah, it's well said. I do have one more question.
Yes.
We always end on this one, but talk finances, talk passion, talk what your work looks like. What is enough?
Mm-hmm.
What is enough for you, for your husband? What does that look like? How does it play out?
That's the best question to ask an entrepreneur, because I think if you don't have a vision for that, you're just going to work yourself to death, right?
Yeah.
So my husband has worked for the state for most of his career. So he has a pull the plug date in mind. Mm-hmm. And we talk about that frequently, about what that looks like. And for me, is it continuing to just be part of this, but letting other people run it and benefiting that way? Is it a sale? I have no interest in sort of the expansion or franchise thing, but maybe that's an exit strategy at some point for someone. Mm-hmm. But for us, enough is being comfortable. We love to travel, so having some freedom from that, like to not be tied here all the time. 2 years ago, I went to Portugal. My husband's a big hunter-gatherer, country gentleman.
Love it.
So he takes big bird hunting trips, upland bird hunting trips in the fall. So he doesn't like to go with me anywhere in the fall. So 2 years ago, I'm like, this is BS. I'm going to start doing things myself. If I have to wait, we'll find other times to travel together. So I took myself to Portugal for 2 weeks on my own, and it was so, it was like so blissful. A, to not have to make decisions with anybody else. Mm-hmm. Like I could do whatever felt like, if I wanted to spend $300 on dinner, I could do it. It wasn't $600 because it was just me. So everything was just more focused on what I felt like doing. One day I rented a bike and just rode down the coast and stopped. It was like the best little French thing on the sea, and no one was there because it was
awesome.
It was amazing. Staff was fine without me. Like I was not I was not needed. And so I'm like, I'm going to do this every year. So last year I booked a trip to Copenhagen, which then this project kept getting pushed back and pushed back, and I ended up canceling it because it was happening right at the same time when this was opening. And and what I found myself is like, I'm right back in startup mode again. Like I had kind of worked to a good place with Magpie, and now I'm like right back at the beginning.
Yeah.
And so I feel like I have a little bit of like stuff where I have to get through that again until I'm back to that nice balance of being needed but not critical to daily operations.
I like that.
Yeah. So for me that feels like a good place. I don't feel like the urgent need to retire anytime soon or to ride off into the sunset. But I do like the balance of being comfortable and also having some freedom with what I do with my time. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. You strike me as the type of creative person that even if you did quote retire, another project would find its way into your lap.
My husband is like a YouTube junkie. Like he like learns about places to go and he scouts places with all these YouTube videos. And I'm like, what if when we retire, we have a YouTube channel?
Yeah. It's already starting.
So like, I'm going to take, so.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, thank you for your time.
Of
Thanks
course.
For inspiring us. Yeah. And it was a pleasure sitting and chatting with you. Thank you.
It's great. This is fun.